If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. The Horde was the name given to the vast Mongol Empire that stretched across huge swathes of land for almost three centuries, from the 13th century right up to the end of the 15th. But how was this vast empire ruled, and what was life like within it? Marie Favreau, Associate Professor of History at Paris-Nanterre University, has written The Horde, How the Mongols Changed the World. Her book has been shortlisted for the Kundal History Prize, of which History Extra is a media partner. And our content director, David Musgrove, caught up with her to find out more.
Let's start off with the first line of your introduction. The Horde was neither a conventional empire nor a dynastic state, even less a nation state. So that's quite interesting. So what on earth was the Horde?
Well, yeah. So the Horde actually was the western part of the Mongol Empire. So it was it took shape in the early 13th century, first half of the 13th century. It lasted until the early 16th century. And it covered most of what is Russia today. It covered Kazakhstan, so part of Central Asia. It covered a part of Eastern Europe, Ukraine, part of Bulgaria as well. So it was a really huge, political construction, a really huge political regime. And it was founded by the descendant of the eldest son of Genghis Khan. So his eldest son was called Jochi, and his descendant, we call them the Jochi, they founded the Horde, and they will remain in power on the throne until the 16th century.
So it covers a big geographical area and a big chronological period, but what sort of polity was it? What are we talking here? So you say it's not an empire, it's not a state. What is it?
Yeah, well, it's a kind of empire, but it's not a conventional empire. It's like not like a Roman empire. There's no capital. And what is specific is that they are nomads. The rulers are nomads and remain nomads up to the end of, the 15th century, 16th century. It's a nomadic power. They build cities, but they don't have a capital. So they have a different ways of dealing with, power administration. They are very mobile. What my interest in this book was really to focus on their political regime from inside, how they, organize politics, how they gather, because they are nomads and so they live separately. So that's why the Horde is not a typical, it's not like a nation state. It's another kind of state or another kind of empire, if you want.
And the actual word, the Horde, and this area is also sometimes called the Golden Horde. What does that mean?
Well, so the word itself, or Orda, Ordu, is an old Turkic Mongolian term. It's, it's a term you see in the sources from even for earlier period. And it had different meanings. It could mean like military camp, court, But at the time of the Mongols, it became a very important term. That's what the way they named their power, their political organization, economic organization. They call it the Horde. So I found it very intriguing and interesting that at the same time, in Europe, in what is Russia today, in the Middle East, they would keep the word Horde. So the word appeared in all these languages in the 13th century. They did not translate the term Horde because they thought, wow, this is something new. We don't have a word for it. So let's stick to the word the Mongols themselves used. And somehow the term, now had very different implication. Horde, it means like a bunch of people, violent, disorganized. But actually, in the 13th century, Horde was a highly organized, powerful state. So I thought it was very interesting to keep the word and to, explain to the bigger audience what was the real meaning of that term.
And the sense that it was sometimes called the Golden Horde?
Yes, what does that mean? Right. So Golden Horde actually means Imperial Horde. So royal, imperial, so gold, golden, this is something we see often in the sources because it's connected to kingship. But my idea, so actually historians like Golden Horde, this terminology, they use it often, like my Russian colleagues use it. It's very common in historiography. But I realized that the interesting aspect of this history was this political construction. What is behind this, name Golden Horde? This the Horde is the system itself. So my interest is really like to understand the inside the regime, what is behind this dynastic history that we call Golden Horde and a king after another. Well, no, what's behind it? How did they, gathered and discuss, war, peace, diplomacy, all this. So I wanted to focus on this and not on, the traditional way of narrating history with, rise of a state, flourishing moment and then decline. I wanted to tell something else. And colleagues who also work on nomadic, empires are interested because they say that Horde is also perhaps a specific institution, something really specific to the nomads. So that's why it's good to sort of forget a little bit about Golden Horde, Imperial Horde, but think about Horde, what's in it, right?
Okay. Now, you mentioned to start with that the Horde was born out of the imperial building aspects of Genghis Khan, Genghis Khan. But it was only one bit of the greater Mongol Empire, right? So what are the other bits to this Mongol polity?
Yeah. So the there are several big regions. One is covered what is China today. We call them the Yuan. And one was in Central Asia, where you see the Uyghur today, and part of Uzbekistan. And we call them the Chagatai Khanate. And one is in the south. And it's covered actually a bit of Afghanistan, Iran, up to Anatolia. We call them the Ilkhanate or Ilkhanid. And then you have what we call the Horde or the Golden Horde, so in the north, Russia, and a bit of Eastern Europe. So all these parts are independent politically, but still connected. The Horde is part of the Mongol Empire, although they have their own organization. They decide on their ruler themselves. They don't ask the other, Mongol rulers. So they are connected, but independent, a little bit like a federation or they are kind of Commonwealth organization. So in my book, I was very keen to show how they remain connected. It's the same world for the Mongol of the Horde. They are closed. They are very close to the Ilkhanid or to the Yuan, but they have their own, they can take their own decision, especially when it comes to, their neighbors, war, diplomacy with, their European neighbors, for instance. So it's a kind of a very interesting kind of political relationship and economic relationship as well with the other part of the Mongol Empire. Now we have to understand that this part, the Mongol hordes of the West, will last longer than the rest of the Mongol Empire. So it's a little bit of a mystery in a sense that the Mongol Empire collapsed, let's say, at the end of the 14th century, but the horde remained very strong, like a major political actor in the north up to the 16th century. So we had to explain this. So it's about the Mongol Empire, but it's about a leading part and a very and like a most enduring part of the Mongol Empire.
We should just stop a second, just go back, because we haven't quite clarified how the Mongol Empire actually got to this part of Russia, how the horde started. So the Mongols spread from the east, these nomadic peoples, and they took over other peoples. Can you just very quickly chart that story for us, how Genghis Khan and his descendants actually managed to form this empire?
Yeah, so the Mongol conquest out of what is Mongolia today started in 1207, 1208 under the guidance and control of Genghis Khan. So he was the leader of a number of nomadic groups, including Mongols, not only Mongols, but they were all called Mongols. It's a term I used as a political term almost, right? And in the 13th century, they will conquer northern China. They will conquer a part of central China. They will conquer the important part of Central Asia. So the Muslim world start being involved in this big history up to the death of Genghis Khan in 1227. His sons and grandson will continue his work, the conquest. So the conquest period will actually continue up to the end of the 13th century. So it's one century of conquest. After the death of Genghis Khan, one of his great son called Batu will take over the conquest in the west towards so what is Russia and Europe. They will integrate actually the western part of Asia in the 1240s, 1250s into the Mongol Empire. After that, they will conquer the south of China. At the end of the 13th century, they will also try to invade Japan. It will be a failure, but they will keep Korea into the empire, and Korea will actually play a very important role in the Mongol Empire. So you have one century of conquest, but during this century of conquest, you already have administration. It's important not to think about, okay, there's first there's conquest, then administration and peace, and then possibly like decline or, you know, transformation. No, from the early 13th century, the Mongol, they conquered new people, they integrate new people in their empire, new lands, new cultures. They develop, they change, and they administrate at the same time. And their own administration will evolve up to the, you know, 14th century. So it's very mobile also in that sense. I think that the Western part was particularly actually interesting and dynamic because they had this connection with Europe and also actually with the Middle East through the Caucasus. So that's what I demonstrate in the book.
What did it actually mean to be a Mongol though? Because you mentioned that the Mongols, that word encompasses lots of groups of people, I think. Is it an ethnic definer? Is it a cultural term? What does it actually mean?
Well, yes, thank you for this very interesting question, because of course the term today, we use it and we think about Mongolia, but we really have to think differently if we turn to the past. Mongol was really a political term. It was a term clearly chosen by Genghis Khan. It existed before, but he chose this term. There were others. He chose this one to name the people he would support, his followers, the member of his group, let's say. And I'm not happy with terms like tribe, and I really want to show that they have their, because what you mean by tribe, it's not very clear, I think. So they really built a new nation in a way. So the term is, you can become a Mongol in the 13th century. That's very interesting to see how groups who, you know, had other names, other, you know, have their own lineages, would enter the Mongol polity. And that's something really interesting to see, because that's clearly something that make the Mongol very strong. They are able to integrate new people. They are able to absorb newcomers. And that's also, socially speaking, it's rare, and it's very interesting to study it.
So just thinking about another empire, the Roman Empire, you could become a citizen of Rome. Is it synonymous with that then? Is being a Mongol the same sort of phrase as being a citizen of Rome?
Yeah, well, I would say, no, I don't think it's exactly the same, but the process is the same, in the sense that you want to have more followers when you know, how can they enter even the state apparatus? How can they enter, like, you know, the official administration? How can they be part of the power, in a way, to share? So you have to share part of your power with the newcomers. So, of course, the Mongol way is a little bit different. They would ask people to take part of the administration of the army or the religious clergies, depending on the origin of the people, depending on their level of loyalty as well. So they will test them in a way. So you would be tested. If they see that you're a loyal person, then you will gain a lot of, you know, tax exemption, a lot of benefits, and then you would become at some point a Mongol, or almost like a Mongol in terms of rights. But at the same time, the really highest position, so we call it Khan, so it means ruler, emperor, it has to be someone from Genghis Khan's family. So it's very, they cannot fear that a stranger would take the power. They feel safe because they have this very rigid system that the ruler has to be a descendant of Genghis Khan through the male lineage. But thanks to this very rigid aspect, then they can open doors to, you know, many different people, different language, different way of life, not only nomads, also sedentary people, because they have this, you know, they don't fear that these people would take the power from them. So so it's interesting to see how they are supple in some ways and open. Yes, okay, you can become a Mongol, but you would never become, or your son will never become, you know, the ruler. So they needed both, you know, to have a balance.
Okay, so that answer sort of dipped into a bit of the answer, I suspect, to the next question, as to how did a nomadic people, and you said they remained nomadic for much of this period, how did a nomadic people rule an empire? How do you do that? I mean, when we think of empires, you imagine that you need some sedentary structure, some place from which you can rule from. What was their process?
There are two things. One is the way they do with people, as I said, absorption. So each time they conquered a new people, like, for instance, the Tangut in, you know, what is central and western China today. Tangut people were integrated into their armies, and Tangut people were very good at, engineering, like building war machine, and they asked them to build, you know, to continue their work, to build war machines, to attack cities, and they integrated them in their own, you know, military administration, in their armies. That's just one example. They also conquered important, you know, sultanate in Central Asia and Iran. There, they were like Persian secretaries. They would accountants as well, like merchants, accountants. They would integrate them in their administration, also in financial administration, immediately. So they have this way of, you know, growing and you know, integrating people. That's probably very specific to the nomad. At the same time, they also would be very seasonal. They are nomads and they are herders, and they do pastoralism, and they would respect like seasonality very much. So they would fight during certain season and rest during other season. So they also have this very specific organization. And regarding mobility, they have all these groups, so all these hordes actually, all over the empire, very often near big river valley. And they communicate in between the hordes. They communicate by sending horsemen on a very big postal and, you know, network system that we call the Yam. And the Yam system is a very important part of their power. It's really how they built their communication network. So you could communicate in between, you know, two river valleys where you have two hordes. Let's say there are 200 miles in between, by sending a very quick, you know, messengers on a horse. He could change his horse to, you know, once he arrived at the post, and get, you know, food and rest, and then go and continue his mission. And this system was very well implemented by the Mongols, and it explained how they, you know, you need communication when you want to build an empire. That's the way they made it. And seasonality is also important, because it means that they were able to face like, you know, harsh winters, or even in Russia, they had this experience in Mongolia. They could also face very dry summer. So they had this, very clever way of understanding nature and weather and ecology.
Can you give us a sense of the world view of a Mongol, their nature and purpose? Because I'm wondering, why did they want to expand this empire? Why did they want to develop this empire? Because from reading your book, it seems like they weren't interested necessarily in the traditional sort of Western idea of wealth acquisition. In fact, there's a very interesting anecdote you have about one of the Khans giving away a load of money, a load of silver bars, because he couldn't see the point of storing it. So what were they trying to do? Why did they want to rule?
Yeah, well, actually, yes, they were interested in wealth and power, but they want wealth and power for themselves, for their society. But what they want also is a circulation of wealth, like a form of redistribution. It's not because they are it's not because they were specifically turned to, you know, want to defend poor people, or no, it's clearly connected to their beliefs. They have, you know, a spiritual notion of what circulation could bring to a society, to a people. And for them, what counts is not only the living, it's the future generation and the dead. And the living are in charge with both. And the living have to share the wealth with, you know, the dead and with the future generations. How? Through rituals of redistribution. There's a lot of rituals also to, you know, make things circulate, not only like physically, but also spiritually. And they believe that this is how a people can, you know, survive and continue over and over the generations. And they have this really strong belief. So it's very material in a way. It's, yes, it's wealth, yes, it's power, but they don't hoard it. They make it circulate. And if they do that, it's really in connection with their spirituality and the way they see the afterlife. So they are very, you know, it's a very different way of the way we see it today. I guess it was very specific to their, you know, to their world. But I think it explains a lot. It explained why economic exchange, long distance trade, was so important for the Mongols. It's not only that they want to gain more, you know, they don't have only, you know, appetite for more treasures, but it's also because they believe that if they have more and they share more and they distribute more, this will multiply and multiply, and this will, you know, help their children and their grandchildren. And so, yeah, I think that's something that would be like, you know, like a driver for them.
So was there an initial sort of formal Mongol religion? Is that what you just described? And what happened when they came into contact with the other world religions? You mentioned that they hit up against Islam, and obviously they also hit up against Christianity as they moved west. So what happened there?
Well, actually, it's not yet. They have their own belief very clearly, but it's not like a formal religion. They are not like dogma. It's different from Christianity. It's different from Islam and Buddhism. And we try to reconstruct it. It's difficult because, of course, we don't have a lot of sources. So we see description of their rituals. We see through archaeology some objects. So we figure out. Shamanism probably had a very important place in this, in those rituals, or maybe, you know, also probably astrologist as well. This was very important. Medicine men in general had a very important place also at the time of Genghis Khan and after. The very interesting thing with the Mongols is that in the 13th century, you see that they were also very open very early on in the maybe already in the 1220s, early 1220s, they were interested and open to the other religions, to Buddhism, but also Taoism, to, of course, different, you know, different forms of Christianity. I mean, Orthodox Armenians were very important in western part of the Mongol Empire, and of course Muslim religion. That they were interested, but the Mongols were so they made their choice. Some rulers decided to convert, but they were two things. First, they will keep their older belief, so they will combine them. They decided that they did not; it was not a problem that they could combine their rituals, old, you know, step beliefs and rituals, and Islam and Christianity, and Buddhism. And at the same time, they don't want their subject to convert like them. They don't want to have specifically the same religion as their subject. It's not an issue for them, and so they will let their subject choose their religion as soon as they remain loyal, as soon as they pay taxes. It's clearly said in the sources, as soon as they pay taxes, let them believe or, you know, practice their religion. That's very, very special and interesting for this medieval period. And also they developed interesting policies regarding religious practices. They decided that clergies, let's say at least the high members of clergies, had to be protected, and that they had to have time for, you know, make prayers and do practice their religion and organize the cult. So they would exempt them from taxes, and they will exempt them from military conscription. So the clergies, Muslim clergies, Christian clergies, clearly also also Jewish clergies, and of Buddhist clergies were considered as protected people, and they would not pay taxes. They would gain a lot from the Mongol power, actually, across the centuries of 13th and 14th centuries. And that's this very interesting policy. I call it in my book Tarkhan, Dahkan, so exemption policy. Will have huge consequences on, you know, this after on all this religion, because they will be very prosperous, they will flourish, and it can be explained through the, you know, this political decision of the Mongols.
Sounds like they were quite pragmatic in many respects in the way they were. What was it like to be ruled by the Mongols? What was it like to be a subject people, do you think? Would it have been a pleasant experience? Or?
I don't know. I think it depends. You have to show your loyalty, but and to pay the taxes and you know, but after that, it It depends where in the empire. In the Western part, I show in my book that actually the connection with the Russian was not so bad. They were not so violent after the time of the conquest in the 1240s. Then they will develop a lot of, form of exchange, cultural exchange. And the Mongols also, they did not live in cities. Although they can finance and, support city construction. They live in the steppe. So they don't really show themselves, as harsh rulers like every month of the year. Though their subjects, sedentary subjects, feel only, that they are in charge, that the Mongol are the lords, when once a year they have to pay the tribute and the taxes. So I think it's at the end explain why they did not have so bad relationship, but on the contrary, rather good relationship. And the Mongol also, had asked, that's something important. That's probably not typically Mongol, but typically nomad. They want their subject, or let's say the chieftain of their subject, the head of their subject, to come and visit them. They want to see them physically at least once a year for a certain period of time. They invite them. So, for instance, the Russian prince would be invited in the Mongol horde, and he would have to stay and live as a nomad with the Khan, the ruler, and talk about, politics also. And this is something that was very important for the Mongols. They would ask, you're our loyal subject. You have to come and visit us, and we'll give you also gift, and we'll give you advice, and we'll decide together. And that's the way they practice politics also.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
If the Mongol really hired you as an ambassador or, a merchant like Marco Polo was hired by the Great Khan, for instance, the Mongol would give you a kind of passport. Actually, it's more like a metal tablet. It could be made of, silver or gold or iron. And you would show it to people to make them, obey or respect you.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What would it have been like to visit the Khan in his felt tents?
We think that the Khan's horde was much bigger than all the other hordes, and that it was very impressive. That's what the visitors described. The traveler, they would say, it's huge, like a city, a mobile city. So it's very impressive. And also it's extremely organized inside. So it's not like a city, like a sedentary city where we know there were, even possibly like danger and disorganization. And well, a city is not, always really well organized. Well, nomadic camp horde was extremely disciplined. There's a lot of discipline, and people know their place. They know where they have to stay with their tent and their family. It's all decided. There are a lot of hierarchical, behind decision behind it. So it depends of, your connection. So if you're connected to the Khan, if you're an important person, you will be closer to his own tent. Otherwise, you can be far away from him, like miles away. In the horde, you would find, though that's something also maybe worth to mention, you would find craftsmen, you would find to workshops, ceramic workshops, iron, people working on, iron, silver, like metal workshop. You would find markets. You would find animals, although part of the animals can be also sent away for, you know, sanitary reason or for sake of place. So you would not, what I mean is, you would not only find warriors and men, you would find a lot of women and children also. So yeah, we have some description. And if you are a foreigner and you want to stay with the Mongols, then you have to... be careful, because there are a number of rules that you have to respect. There are rituals that you have to respect, so you cannot use like water without, you know, consideration. You have to not to touch the door when you enter the tent. There are a number of rules that are connected to the Mongol spirituality that, you know, you really have to pay attention to. And that's interesting, because we have in the sources a description of, you know, how you behave. And if you go to the Khan, how you move in the tent, which side you go, how you sit, when do you talk, and all this information we have. So it's make it really lively. Like, you know, you feel, well, if I were there, how should I, you know, behave myself? But all the visitors said that it's safe to be inside. That's why it's very different from a medieval city. It was not safe to be, you know, in Paris in the 13th century. You really had to be careful, robbery, whatever. Well, in the Mongol horde, no, there's no such thing that robbery, for instance, yeah, a lot of discipline. But you have to, you know, respect their rules.
Okay, so a potential sort of diplomatic minefield as you're going around. What might you have got involved in a drinking festival? Because you sort of talk about this substance called kumis, this fermented mare's milk, which seems to be a really important part of Mongol society, and the fact they had these massive drinking festivals. So tell us a bit about them.
Yeah, absolutely. So kumis, or arak in Mongolian, is fermented mare milk. And it's still produced today in Mongolia and in Central Asia. And it's produced in spring because of the lactation of the mare. And the production can last until the end of summer, let's say until September, but not after that. So it's a part of the year, like let's say 3-4 months, when it's a special moment. So you have this production of milk, and Mongol do fermented mare milk. So it's not the level, I mean, the fermentation turn it into like very, very light beer, I would say. So you have to drink really a lot to get drunk. So, but we know that studies, and we know that this fermented mare milk bring a lot of vitamins, a lot of minerals. It's very, very good for the health. So if you drink a lot of it, and if you are like a Mongol meat eater, then it will preserve you. It will protect your body from, you know, all the problems you get if you eat too much meat. So the Mongol actually have this special diet. During summer, during the lactation period, they would only almost drink this fermented mare milk, this kumis, and they would not eat really meat, and they would be really a very special moment for their body. It's important to understand that, because it means that after they will be also strong warrior, because they have this special diet, right? This time also, so spring, summer, it's the time when the Mongol gather. They organize drinking festival, so they can drink, you know, a lot of this kumis. And it's also the moment when they will do politics and discuss together, and will gather with the horde that, you know, were far away, because it's a huge empire. So they gather together. They also organized, you know, so games and a pleasant moment, but also trial. They, you know, it's also a moment when they decide sometime, you know, they take sometime very harsh decision too. So they can decide on war for next year. So this moment of the drinking festival is key in, you know, the Mongol, in the Mongol year, I would say. I mentioned earlier, like, the importance of seasonality, and I said there are time for war and time for peace or rest. Well, the time for rest and peace is the drinking festival, so spring and summer, winter is time for war. So Mongol would always do war in winter, except when they have no other option, but they will usually use winter for summer. And that will also puzzle a lot of sedentary, you know, people, like the Russian, for instance, were not used to do war in winter. So they were really surprised to be attacked during, you know, the worst season of the year. They would be very surprised and not prepared to answer those attacks. While the Mongols were really able to, you know, survive through harsh winter. But the Mongols stop everything, you know, in March, April. They have to stop because they are headers. They have the drinking festival. It's a key moment. They have to organize it. It's key to themselves, really.
Sure. And I've read in a few places that this kumis is quite an acquired taste. Have you tried it? What's it like?
Of course. I love it. Well, each kumis is different. Each family produced its own kumis. So you taste it and you pick up the one you prefer. But it's not only good for your health. I mean, honestly, I think it's very good. I mean, I love it personally. I know that some travelers, like Franciscan friars in the 13th century, were horrified because they were like, what is this? We have to drink it because, you know, the Khan offered you a cup of kumis at court. This is not something you can just, you know, refuse. You have to drink it. So, and also it's interesting because in Islam, you're not supposed to drink alcohol. And the question was like, kumis, you know, it's fermented. So are we allowed to? And during the Mongol period, yes, the Muslims were usually using kumis, drinking it. It was really accepted. It was a very special beverage, really. I think today one should really try to go to, you know, Kazakhstan or Mongolia, but during this period, there's no kumis in winter. I mean, if you find some in winter, it means like, you know, it's industrial stuff. It's not a real one.
Okay. Now you mentioned earlier when you were talking about the Khan's encampment, the Feltwall tent area, that it was safe. It was safe to be there. Does that apply across the whole extent of the Horde and the wider Mongol Empire? Was it a safe place for people to move around? Because you kind of get a sense that this area was ruled with a certain discipline and that crime wasn't tolerated in quite the same way as perhaps, well, a crime's not tolerated in other places, but it wasn't quite such a factor in life as in other places.
Yes, no, it depends where and who you are. We have also description of merchants, especially Italian merchants, wanted to cross the Mongol Empire because it was possible in the 13th and 14th century. They wanted to cross, they wanted to trade. So they were worried, what shall I do to be, am I going to be safe? So of course, you would have to travel if you're a foreigner. You really had to travel with other people. You would not go by yourself alone in the steppe. It was not a good idea. So you would go with group of, you know, caravan, group of merchants. It was very important if you want to communicate with the nomad to have a gift to exchange with them. That also they would ask you. So that created some problems with the missionaries because, you know, Franciscan, Dominican missionaries who visited and stay in the Mongol Empire, they were poor by it's the way they were, like missionaries. They didn't have gift or nothing. So it was very difficult for them to get accepted in the beginning because nobody understood who they were and what they wanted. So, but at the end, they remained and they even worked for the Mongols. So the Mongols were actually, you know, quite open to foreigners. And as I said, you had to respect a number of rules and you could be safe. Although, of course, it was really important either to know some officials that would, you know, help you, protect you. It was very important to have translators with you. Because, you know, you have to communicate with people. And so the merchants knew where they could hire translators, for instance. And they knew also about the roads that you should take to be safe and cross the empire. So this kind of news circulated in the 13th and 14th century and helped, you know, travelers, foreigners, you know, even ambassadors to be safe. If the Mongol really hired you as an ambassador or, you know, a merchant like Marco Polo was hired by the Great Khan, for instance, the Mongol would give you a kind of passport. Actually, it's more like a metal tablet. It could be made of, you know, silver or gold or iron. And you would show it to people to make them, you know, obey or respect you. So the Mongol had developed also numbers of things that make clear for the subject, oh, this person is connected to the power, so I have to be careful. So tablets or passport, you could also wear special clothes. You could have also, you need to have a horse or a big, you know, camel, or because it shows your status. So anything that shows clearly your status to others, you know, also makes things clear when you're a foreigner. But otherwise, I mean, in cities and, you know, in the steppe, the situation was not that bad. I mean, in terms of safety, personal safety.
So this idea of the possibility of safe travel across this massive area that they rule leads us into this idea of the Pax Mongolica and the Mongol exchange, a couple of historical phrases that you deploy in the book. Can you just tell us what that means and when that was manifested?
So there's a clear period of economic flourishing. It's really an economic boom in the second half of the 13th century up to the Black Death in the second half of the 14th century. So it's a long century of, you know, flourishing economic exchange. And this period, we used to call it the Mongol Peace, the Pax Mongolica, because it's the concept was, you know, coming from the Pax Romana, in fact. But I thought with other researchers that the term was not so good because they were in between the Mongols themselves. There were also some fight. I mean, the term peace was strange. And I said before, I don't think it's a right idea to think about the conquest first as a first step and then peace or organization as second step. I think we really have to reconsider this, and that during conquests, one century of conquest, there are moments of peace and moments of organization. And during the after conquest period, we have also moments of war, of very harsh economic competition between Mongols. So this appellation, I mean, I didn't like. And I turned to the term Mongol exchange, which I like much better. Mongol exchange, a little bit like Colombian exchange. So it's mean, it's a huge phenomenon. It means that this period of history is not only about the Mongol Empire, geographically speaking, it will be about all the neighbors, all the other states and empire that were connected to the Mongols in a way or another through trade or diplomacy. It means that we are going to think about the effect, very far-reaching effect of the Mongol developments, the Mongol trade policies. So if you work on Venice or Florence, or Pisa in the 14th century, you will see the connection with the Mongols. You will see the effect of the Mongol Empire on, you know, Western Europe. If you work on England also, they had connection in the 13th and early 14th century with the Mongol trade connection, diplomatic connection. Northern Europe as well. So Mongol exchange mean that what the Mongol Empire did changed the world around them too. And we should not only focus on, you know, the Mongol and their frontiers, the frontiers of the empire, but also on the, you know, consequences of their, economic policy. And also on the fact that their neighbors would, you know, interfere. They would, when the Italians come into the Mongol Empire, they interfere also. They have their, you know, their share. They can bring something new. They can create problems, but they can also, you know, there are also a lot of positive aspects. So it's a different way of seeing the phenomenon to say Mongol exchange in that sense. And that's the same way when people worked on, you know, the connection between Europe and America. when you think about Colombian exchange, you immediately understand that it's not only about, you know, European, you know, these European nations. No, it's all the consequences are already there in the term. So also, of course, disease, this kind of thing we now study for the Mongol Empire. Black Death, it's really a moment of, you know, and in connection with Mongol Empire policy. So,
well, on that, thank you. That's a really fascinating way of looking at it. But talking specifically about the Black Death there, so mid 14th century, here in the West, we're very aware of the impacts of the Black Death on medieval societies here and the consequences of it and the societal and economic changes that perhaps devolve from it. Did the Black Death and the pandemic, which came through Mongolia, people think, did it change society and culture in the Horde as well?
Certainly. First, we know that many people died in the elite, so it created a lot of problems at the highest level because, you know, no more rulers. Many people died in every level of the society. That's explain a part of their political issues, internal political issues. Also, of course, we know that each time they would organize a war expedition and sit in front of a city for, you know, months, plague or something that looked like plague very clearly would, you know, appear and destroy the warriors. So it would change the way they practice war and the way they attacked cities. It will have really very clear consequences, especially so around this episode of the Black Death in the mid-14th century. But we know now that the Mongol knew about the plague well before, and that plague was in the Mongol Empire before, in fact, and that they had their own ways also to deal with it. Plague or other, you know, very dangerous disease. They had their own way to sort of, like, they developed, I don't know if I can put it that way, but like sanitary policy. Yeah, you'd sort of, you know, push, you when you identify the, you know, the disease and who has it, and you don't enter the tent of the person. I mean, there are a lot of rules, and we know they knew how to deal with it. What I think was in my book, what I show is that they did not expect that Western Europe, for instance, or the Middle East would be so unprepared facing the plague. And these were their main neighbors. These were their, you know, partners. Their partners, economic partners, suddenly, to the world around them, suddenly collapsed in a way. And I think that was actually even worse for the Mongol than having their own internal problems with the plague. And we of course, the end of the Mongol Empire, it's not only because of the plague, but it's we have to take it into account. I mean, it changed everything in the second half of the 14th century.
Okay, so moving on, I would love to talk to you for hours and hours, but I realize we need to get to an end point. You mentioned the end of the Mongol Empire, and earlier on you also told us that the Horde sort of outlived the other elements of that empire. So how did the Horde come to an end? Did the Mongols stick to their sort of nomadic lifestyle to the end, or did they become sedentary and just sort of fold into a different lifestyle?
Yes. Thank you very much for this question, because I think it's really important to understand that the Mongol would never become sedentarized. I mean, they would remain up to the end nomad. It's part of themselves. They didn't even consider it. For them, it would be almost like a nonsense to sort of change this way of life, because it was the way of life of their ancestors and also because it's their identity. But in the, let's say, early 15th century and all during the 15th century, what changed for the Mongol were the world around them, actually. And I said a word of it, it's connected to the episode of Black Death, but not only. I mean, the rise of the Ottoman the Ottoman will in the 15th century will control the at the end the Black Sea, for instance. The Black Sea is a very important door to Europe for the Mongols. This door will be blocked by the Ottoman. So the Russian also start being really well organized, more unified. I say Russian to, you know, speak to put it simply, but they were Russian principalities, and it was very fragmentary in this part of, you know, the Slavic world. Then they were unified because the Mongol forced them to unify, and the response, the answer of the Russian at some point in the 15th century was, you know, now we are unified, we are stronger, and they start, you know, fighting the Mongol, or at least, you know, showing them that they are not the subject they were in the early 13th century. So in Central Asia, new powers, new nomadic powers. You've heard of Timur, Tamerlan appeared. So the world around them changed, and the Horde changed because the world around changed too. And it's a very supple regime. They were really able to transform many things. I think the best example would be like they built cities in the lower Volga Valley. They abandoned their cities. They decided, well, it doesn't fit, I mean, with the situation now. We don't need them. It's like, it's heavy to carry in a way, and we don't need them anymore. So they really made choice, political choice. They withdrew and they changed and transformed. And I show in the book that in the 16th century, they really became so different. So now we talk about, you know, Kazakh, Uzbek, other names appear in the source too. So it's the end of this nomadic regime. It had transformed completely, but still there's an heritage, of course.
Okay, and then last thing to finish up, I just want to sort of try and tackle the subhead of your brilliant book, which is How the Mongols Changed the World. So you've mentioned this a little bit earlier, but if I asked you to kind of summarize the legacy of the Mongols and the Horde specifically in a minute or a couple of minutes, would you have a go at that?
Yes, well, I would say that the key thing is the globalization effect of the Mongol Empire, and especially of the Horde in the 13th, 14th, up to 15th century. This is a moment of globalization that we forgot completely. We historians, I mean, for long, we really thought about, you know, the 16th century at the key moment for the earliest complex form of globalization. And then now we realize, well, no, there's a past, and we forgot this past. And there were other experience and other they built another system before. It's different from what we have today. We cannot speak about like a direct legacy. It's more complex, of course. But we cannot understand the development of the world from the 16th century onward up to today if we don't understand the Mongol period. This is really the beginning of something completely new. They put also together communities, polity that were not used to be together. They also integrated, for instance, the Russian into the Islamic trade network. That was completely new, the way they did it. So they transformed very much the world at that time, and the effects are going to be really, really long-lasting. And one of them, I think, is what they did to the northern part of the world, because the Horde especially was the major power of the north of the world at that time. And they created new roads, they created also new trade rules, they also integrated northern communities from Siberia, from the forest really up north, into the heart of, you know, of economy, of Eurasian economy, that which was more in the Middle East actually at that time. And they also integrated the Northern Europe trade, the development of trade in the Hanseatic League, that we know the Hanseatic League really developed because of the Mongols. So this is something that is very specific to the western part of the Mongol Empire, to the Horde. So a lot of things, also monetarization, they forced the Russian to get monetarized. So there are a huge array of, you know, examples that show that the world in the 16th century exists because they were the Mongols before. So yes, I think we have to take it into account now.
That was Marie Favreau. The Horde, How the Mongols Changed the World, is out now, published by Belknap Press. We'll be broadcasting more interviews with authors on the Kundal History Prize shortlist over the coming weeks, so do listen out for those. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. Be sure to check in again tomorrow, when we'll be exploring George III's eventful life with the historian Andrew Roberts.